All right, it's time for us to get started in here, and we're going to hopefully finish the book of Esther tonight. Now, do you have a Bible program on your phone? Bobo, you got a Bible program on your phone? If you got a Bible program, I want you to find the first time the word God is found in the book of Esther. Any of you can do that. It's just a search and find the first time the word God is found in the book of Esther. If you don't have a smartphone, you might just want to can you skim real fast and see the word God in the book of Esther? Just find the first time. And we'll try to look at it the first time. And if we have time, we'll look at it the second and third time. If you'll help me find where the word God is in the book of Esther. Holter, you got a smartphone and everything? I thought for sure you'd be the one who would find that for me. Don't have it tonight, okay? All right, let's get to the book of Esther. I want to start in chapter 7, and I know that we're beyond chapter 7 in our study, but that's the background. Haman, evil Haman, has gone out to destroy the Jews, paid the king 10,000 pieces of silver, and now has issued a decree that every Jew is to be killed. It's the sunset of Judaism. Well, not that every Jew was to be killed, was subject to being killed. And if you kill a Jew, you get their possessions. That's not a bad... Chad, I know you love hunting. And so if you lived at that time, just go find you some little short Jew that's got a lot of money and fire away, and you can take all of his money. That's not a bad arrangement and everything. And so that was the decree. Now, remember about Persian law? Once it's issued, it cannot be rescinded. And that's so vital to understand. Now, that worked, by the way, for the Jews when they were ready to rebuild the city, rebuild the temple, because there was that decree from the Persian king, Cyrus the Persian king, that says this temple is going to be rebuilt. And when all of the enemies that were there were trying to keep them from rebuilding the temple, that's not a bad law when it favors you, but when it gets to that other side, like it is in the book of Esther, it is really something. So Mordecai tells Esther, Esther, you need to see what you can do to help this. And we spent almost a half of a class talking about perhaps you've been brought to the kingdom for such a time as this. You need to understand that in your life, circumstances develop, and perhaps you're there for that purpose. Chad, you're headed for Mississippi. Is that what I heard? You got a little place to live yet? Haven't got a place to live at. Chad, in that apartment, in that complex where you're going to be living, perhaps in that very building is somebody that needs the gospel. Isn't that interesting? To live your life that way. You live the rest of your life, every person you meet. It changes your worldview tremendously. And we need to recognize that. Perhaps this person you meet, you know, on the way home you have a wreck. You've got that person's name and address right there. What more could you want? And I'm not encouraging you to go out and have a wreck or anything. But how do you know? How do you know that person that you meet, even somebody that's not kind to you, perhaps, you know, if they're not kind, they really need the gospel. You know, now if they've got an AK-47, you need to walk a little bit more carefully, but you got a sword, and so you need to understand that. I love that concept from the book of Esther. I've lived oftentimes my life by that very concept. It helps you, the expression we used in New Zealand, the mission field, are you seeing souls? Are you seeing souls? Everybody you run into tomorrow at work, They have a soul. They are a soul, and we've got to see their souls and not see them as just somebody that's coming in to cause trouble or something like that. We've got to view that way. So Esther, knowing that she doesn't have a right to go before the king, that tells you how great that king was, and what a great person he was in authority. You cannot walk into the presence of the king and live unless he extends the scepter out to you. So Mordecai and Esther arranged for Esther to go, the plan for Esther to go before Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus extends the rod to her and says, what do you want, Esther? I'll give you up to half of my kingdom. You know how big that gift is? 127 provinces, and this is on one of the slides of tonight, but if you got a world map inside your head, from India to Ethiopia, he ruled the world. And then in the last chapter, I believe it says, and the islands. I think it's the first time the islands are mentioned. I'm not even sure what those islands are, but it's not just the landmass, but he'd conquered all of the islands that were there. And she said, I'll give you half of those. 127 provinces, you can have 62 or 63 and a half of the provinces. I'll give you up to half of that. And she says, I want you and Haman to come for a banquet tomorrow. And so Haman is so wrapped up in himself and everything, we'll not spend much time at all talking about him, except to talk about how tragic it is that one little thing can ruin your life. He was almost second in command. So I read the expression today that, and this is modern terminology, but think about the British system. Ahasuerus was the king, but Mordecai became the prime minister. I love that concept, you know, if you understand the British, the whole British system. And that's where Mordecai is. And Haman is almost there. He's not quite there. But Haman is the one who says, let's kill all of the Jews, and sends out that decree. Well, whenever they arrive at the palace, this is in chapter 7, the king says to Esther, what's your request? And this is the second time, by the way. And the request was the second time, I want you to save our lives. Somebody has planned to kill me and all of my people. And he said, who is it? And he says, it's Haman. It's this evil man who hates the Jews and specifically hates one Jew, and that's Mordecai. In fact, when Haman is there at this very time, the night before, he's built a gallows 50 cubits high. You think about that in reference to real money. 75 feet up in the air to hang one man on. That is an astounding, manifestation of hate. I think that's it, you know. I don't know when you were a kid, if you threw a temper tantrum, you know, if you broke one of your mama's glasses, you know, or tore up one of your brother's toys or something like that. That's bad enough to get you in trouble, but you go in there and you tear up everything in his room and tear up all of his books and all the rest. That's overkill. And what a play on words, a 75-foot gallows is overkill. And, whenever the king hears this, that's his number two man in the kingdom. And he gets so upset, he walks away, and while he's out of the place, Haman comes and starts begging Esther to do something. Evidently, that's the implication. And when the king walks back in, there's Haman. I want to say laying on the couch, but some way on the couch on which Esther is reclined, and Haman thinks he's trying to assault my wife. We used the word rape last week, and that may be an overstatement. I doubt that it is, if you start thinking about assault in relationship to this, because he was the one going to kill the Jews. It may not be rape. It may be something else. And so he says, kill Haman. And so one of the eunuchs that's there says in the last verses of chapter 7, he's got a gallows built. And so the king says, take him and hang him high. Take him out to the gallows. And on the very gallows on which he had planned to kill Mordecai, and it was going to happen that very morning. The very morning when he was in there at the banquet, he had walked down to the king's palace to get the permission from the king to kill Haman, to kill Mordecai, and it's not going to happen. And that very day, he's put to death. And so, we talked about this last week, Esther was given Haman's house. Now, Haman has 10,000 pieces of silver. Wonder what his house looked like.
Can I say Palm Beach? You know, I mean, you get a picture if I say Palm Beach? That's what the house looked like. I mean, it had to look like this. And so she's given that. Guess who she gives it to? She gives it to her cousin Mordecai. And so here's Mordecai, who has, been living almost out at the gate of the palace and weeping at some times because of the decree that Haman had sent out worldwide. And it is interesting that at that time, the Bible says that Ahasuerus gave to Mordecai the signet ring that Haman had had. And so evidently, before he was sent to the gallows, he took the ring away. It's not absolutely necessary, but seems to fit the flow of the story a whole lot better. And so he gives it to Mordecai because he loves Mordecai. Mordecai, as we talked about way back in chapter 2 or 3, had saved the life of the king from assassination. And so now Esther gives her request. And Esther says, rescind that decree. But Persian law cannot be changed. How are you going to save the Jews? Well, Mordecai's plan is, with the king's approval, is to write a second royal decree. By the way, you found where God is yet? We could go to that verse yet. You found it yet? You hadn't found it? Are you serious? Anybody else look? Johnny, if you find it, Johnny, find the word God. Find the first time it's used in the book. Gail shaking her head, it's not in there. Are you serious? I was going to do this right at the end of class, but I think this is the time to do it. The word God is not in the book of Esther. He's in every verse. Isn't that amazing? Every book of the Bible has some reference to God or to the Lord or to Jehovah or to Jesus. Reference deity, but this is there. The name God is not found in this book. Now, if we have time at the end, we're going to come back and talk about how lucky she was, how everything worked out for her in relationship to this. Well, then how do you save these individuals? Well, here's the plan that goes out. The royal decree to save the Jews is on the day of the first decree. Whenever that was to be, all the Jews could be hunted and killed. On that very day, every Jew has a right to save himself and other Jews. In fact, let them gather together. And so, Jed, you're going out hunting. I want you to know, it's not just that little Jew that you're going to shoot down. There are 700 other Jews with AK-47s when you get there. And the decree is that if they kill you, they get your possessions. How's that for rolling the dice? I'm going hunting and the bear eats you. You understand? I mean that's the kind of thing that's going to happen. That's not what you'd call a good hunting day. And so they said, on that day, the Jews can defend themselves, and this royal decree was delivered to all 127 of the provinces. In fact, the Bible talks about the horses and about how they spread this message and everything. Let's get to chapter 9 then. This is ground we have not plowed as we try to finish this book tonight. In chapter 9, on the day that the Jews were to be killed. Now, what day of the year is that? You know, Jewish calendar or partly Persian calendar, likely. On the 13th day of the 12th month. Now, how did they pick that date? Well, they cast lots. I have no idea what that is. But if you read back in chapter 4, whenever Haman is trying to figure out, evidently, because of the word, I think the word is until in that verse, indicated, they said, is it going to be the first month? And when they cast lots, the first month didn't come up. And so they kept casting lots until they got to the 12th month. And it's on the 13th day of the 12th month, because Haman's decree was written on the 13th day of the first month, and it was to be enacted on the 13th day of the 12th month. Nearly a year from day one, 13th day of January to the 13th day of December. And I'm using modern names for their calendar started at a different time of the year when ours did, and all the rest. Just give us a mental picture of it. Now then, Mordecai's decree was written in the third month. For us to understand, that's March, isn't it? So January, the decree goes out, you can hunt the Jews in December. In March, Mordecai's decree is written and it is sent out and it is distributed, and this is where the verse says, from India to Ethiopia. That's such a massive, massive distance. Now, go back to the fact that whenever Vashti was deposed, when the first queen would not show her beauty in that drunken feast, then the decree went out to all the 127 provinces. How many beautiful damsels were there from India to Ethiopia? That's remarkable, isn't it? It is remarkable that Esther was ever even selected. And obviously, the king was not aware of her, that she was Jewish. And so, chapter 9, verse 2 says, the Jews successfully defended themselves. Well, they've got 9 months to get ready. I don't think they waited till the 11th month or to the first day of the 12th month to get ready. Can you imagine the planning that would have been done? If you knew somebody was going to come and rob your house, and you had 9 months to get ready for it, yeah, I'd be ready for it. You would too. And so whenever that day came, there was not a single Jew that was killed. And then the decree said that the Jews can, on that same day, can go out and kill their enemies. And so they defend themselves, and there's some numbers down here that I think will absolutely surprise you about how many were killed. Because the decree says to the Jews, if you kill your enemies, you can kill any of your enemies you want to, and you can take their possessions. And so they went out and defended themselves, and the Bible indicates in verse 3 and 4 that even the Persian officials assisted the Jews. How's this for a turn of events? God's not in this book. How's this for a turn of events? Here are the Persian officials. You think those officials may have been, and there's a list of the names of them in the text. And so there's a list of some of these names, these officials that were there. And so you've got to not only deal with the fact that you've got this first decree and the second decree, and there's no penalty at all. And the Jews defended themselves. But I want to point out something. They took not one penny of the spoils. Isn't that remarkable? Isn't that remarkable? Sometimes we make good decisions because of who we are without somebody having to tell us that. You need to train yourself in, I don't know exactly how to say this, in the moral, spiritual side of your life. Instead of waiting till some crisis comes into your life and then you spontaneously respond to that. If you wait at that time to develop kindness, if you wait at that time to develop a long-suffering spirit, if you wait at that time and you take any of those biblical words that you might respond to in relationship to that, if you wait at that time to think, well, maybe I ought to be long-suffering. No. If you wait till the crisis comes, you're probably not going to do what's right. Let me tell you something. We need to know right so much that we don't have to all even decide at a time like that, because we've learned the importance. It's always right to do right. If you write that on your soul, that'll help you. When Troy and Josh were here, before they went to Paraguay, they went out hunting for wild hogs. And Josh heard Troy shoot his gun. They were some distance apart. Two shots. And so Josh came out of his stand, wherever he was, to go find Troy. And he got over there. And this hog had come through the bushes that were there. And Josh, being the good shot that he was, shot that thing. And lo and behold, it wasn't a wild hog at all. It was a bear. It's not bear season. But the bear was not dead, so he had to shoot it again, put it out of its misery. And Josh said, he walked over there and Troy was saying, it's always right to do right. The rest of that story was, he went and reported to the game warden, thought that's the right thing to do. And after he reported to the game warden, the game warden Mirandized him. Is that the word I want? Read him his rights and everything. I mean, he didn't like that turn in that. By the way, whenever the game warden went out, said that law wasn't written for you, it was written for poachers. And so nothing ever came of it. But I just thought, Josh said, I walked over there and Troy was saying it's always right to do right. Would you write that on your soul? Do right. And so they didn't take that. They absolutely did not take any of the spoils. And that day in the capital city, in the royal city, they killed 500 of their enemies. And then they said, give us another day. And so the king gave them the right on the day after to go out and kill some more of their enemies. And they killed 300 more of their enemies in that one city. But those 127 provinces, and this is the number that amazed me. I told David, how can I read the Bible and not see things like this? They killed 75,000 of their enemies. Does that sort of change the course of your life? I mean, you stop and think of it. They killed 75,000 of their enemies. They're in this time of the restoration, going back from Babylonian captivity. Not all of them have gone back. But even those that did not go back, God took care of them. You're talking about a time of peace and possible prosperity. Here it is. And so now, the Jews are so blessed that they decide, and they are, starting in chapter 9, the last 14 or 15 verses of chapter 9 tells about this feast that they set up. And so it was a feast, and I'll read to you in a moment about how the feast is observed nowadays, and it's all based on this right here. It's called the Feast of Purim, P-U-R-I-M. It was a Jewish feast day, not one of the three big feast days, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, not one of those feasts. But they set up and they continued that practice as a celebration of a day of national deliverance. If I say July the 4th, there are some places on this earth, Americans don't need to talk about July the 4th and what it stands for, namely New Zealand, where we July the 4th is where we got our independence from Britain. And so we would jokingly say to New Zealanders, well, there's a holiday in America tomorrow. I'm not going to tell you what it's all about, though. The celebration of deliverance. Are there not times when you enjoy singing God Bless America? Yeah. You see bodies that are brought back from Vietnam, from Afghanistan. And those bodies left off the, as they're offloaded off of the plane for the passengers on that plane to start uniformly singing together, God Bless America. How do you reckon the Jews felt about this feast? I hope I've got this other page, and whoever's on the screen back there, if you go to the very last slide on this, I don't know, I think it's 196 or something like that. I think that's the one. Here is the modern celebration of Purim. This is from International Standard Bible Encyclopedia that says, in succeeding generations, as the Jews have passed from one civilization or empire to another. It's the very last slide. Just keep going all the way to the end. I may not have even put it on that flash drive. So just listen. In succeeding centuries, as the Jews have passed from one civilization or empire to another, so many causes have arisen to remind them of the persecutions of Haman, as to make the festival of a triumph over such persecution attractive and significant to them. The 13th day of that month is observed by fasting in commemoration of Esther's prayer and the fasting the Jews were doing as she approached the king. In the evening, at the beginning of the 4th day, the Jews repair to their synagogues, means they assemble, where the book of Esther, and then here's a Hebrew word, and anybody want to pronounce Megillah, something like that, and that's the Hebrew word for rolls. I had no idea what it was. There are five shorter books that the Jews called the rolls, like the book of Ruth, and obviously this book. And so as they divided the Bible up into, you know, into categories, there were those shorter books. We talk about sometimes we'll have a class on the 5-1 chapters books in the Bible or something like that. And so they did that sort of thing. And on this day, the book of Esther is read with interpretations and execrations bursting out at the reading of Haman's name. We've talked about this. In the synagogue, even with the children assembled, they'll read this, and every time the name Haman is mentioned, they start booing. They start, figuratively or maybe even literally shaking their fist at him, accompanied by the noise of rattles and the stamping of feet. Other persecutors and foes also come into the share of execration. The name of Mordecai and Esther receives blessings. On the following morning of the 14th, synagogue services are held again, at which, in addition to the repetition of Esther's reading, which records the destruction of the Amalekites, talks about it's found in Exodus 17, and you've got the Amalekites and King Agag. We talked about him last week because Haman was an Agite. Is also read as the lesson from the law. Presents are given to the poor and to friends, and the rest of the day, and also on the 15th, observed with feasting and rejoicing, even excesses being condoned in the exuberance of a national spirit. Again, that sounds like July the 4th and trying to drive home after the celebration, after everybody looks at the fireworks, when I read that last statement and everything. I want us to look at chapter 10, only three verses in it. I think it's remarkable in chapter 10 that we get to chapter 10. The only three verses. I find it remarkable that Ahasuerus imposes taxes. Sometimes there are things in the Bible, Tim, you and I were talking about this before services. I don't even know why they're there. I mean, you know, they're just things that are there. In my mind, I call attention to them, but he imposed taxes on 127 provinces. That'd be a pretty healthy income, wouldn't it? From Ethiopia to India, and the Bible says he imposed taxes. But then you look at in verse 2, there Mordecai is mentioned in the written account of the Chronicles of Persia. Wouldn't it be wonderfully ironic if someday archaeologists might be able to find this history? It's not been found. But the fact it's not found doesn't mean he did not live. But I think it is interesting that the Bible wants us to see Mordecai for what he was, from a man who had a heart of compassion. And so his uncle dies. And there's a little young lady called Esther, and he raises her. And then the Bible talks about the greatness, and that's in verse 3, that he was the second most powerful man in Persia. He was loved and honored by the Jews, and he sought the good of his people, speaking peace. Book of Esther. Wasn't she lucky? Wasn't she lucky? Lucky to be beautiful. If you happen to fall into that category, don't get too excited. Look at your mother. Someday you're going to look like what she looks like. But she's beautiful. And wasn't she lucky that of all of the young women, if there was one, the most beautiful one from each of the 127 provinces, could there have been as many as two? Could have been five? It takes a year for all of them to be brought to the king. And she sure was lucky that whenever
whenever she was brought to the palace, that there was this eunuch there in whose eyes she finds favor. And he treats her better than any of the other virgins that are there in the palace. Wasn't it, was she just lucky that she had enough sense to ask him, "Now, when I go before the king, wasn't it just lucky that he happened to be there? What should I do to please the king?" And wow, man, wasn't she lucky to be the one chosen? You know, that's not just Miss America. That's Miss Persia of 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. And wasn't she lucky to have someone like Mordecai to raise her? Just lucky. And wasn't she lucky when she went before the king for him to hold out that scepter? And wasn't she lucky that the king says, "I find such favor in you, I'll give you half of my kingdom if you'll just ask"? And wasn't she really, really lucky that Haman happened to be there whenever she's going to the second day and she's going to tell the king of her request? She sure was lucky that Haman was there. He could have been busy some other place and could not have been able. He could have been not have finished the gallows and he's over there working. Just lucky. And wasn't she lucky that when the king walked back in, Haman was where he was? Down to the very place in that room. Wasn't she lucky? And wasn't she lucky that she got Haman's house? And wasn't she lucky that Mordecai had found that assassination plot? And wasn't she lucky that the king had failed to reward Mordecai? And one night, the night before the banquet, the king cannot sleep and he starts reading Persian history and he finds out what about Mordecai and he said, "What have I done to honor this man?" That's his first real introduction to this man, Mordecai. And wasn't she lucky that that Mordecai was her cousin? And wasn't she lucky? You want to finish the book? You want to go through the rest of the book and talk about how lucky she was? And sometimes we say, "I wish you good luck. I wish you good luck on the new job you've got." And I do. But I'm telling you, child of God, it's not good luck. It's good God. Go through this book and become a Jew and have all of the emotions that they had whenever that decree comes out that all of the Jews are to be killed. Isn't that remarkable? That decree's been out there for 2 months. You think there are any some sleepless mamas and daddies seeing their children and knowing that, you know, that in the 12th month they're all going to be dead. And all of the emotions, and you know Persian law cannot be changed, and you would throw up your hands in despair and say, "We're dead." Well, guys, we wish you good luck. No, we have a good God. And whatever's happening in your life,
I stand here and I look at you and know the backgrounds of so many of you. And I think what you've been through. Were you lucky, Freddie? When that man was at the wrong house and had a gun and came to shoot somebody and shot through Freddie's door and shot him 5 times, Freddie? You sure were lucky. Shot him twice. Several shots fired. I'm not saying that if bad things happen to us, because Job says, shall we receive good at the hand of God and not evil? I'm not saying bad luck is evidence that God is angry at you. But if there's anything we ought to get out of this last 5 weeks as we study this book of Esther, it is, I don't need luck. I have God. And so whatever happens, whatever the doctor says next time you go to him, whatever happens in the workplace, whatever happens with your children or your grandchildren, whatever happens, it's not good luck. It's a good God. Thank you so much for being a part of this study tonight and for this whole week.